Now, your host, Michael Cohen, with the Capital City Recap on more compelling talk radio, 1320 WILS.
And we're back, Michael Cohen with producer Desi Simmons. A new Michigan State University study on the American Indian way of life finding that American Indians face some serious challenges, including domestic violence against Native American women and the pollution of American Indian land. To talk about his study titled Race and American Indian Tribal Nationhood, which was recently published in the Wyoming Law Review, I'm joined by Matthew Fletcher, director of the MSU College of Law's Indigenous Law and Policy Center. Welcome to the program, Matthew.
Thank you, Michael.
Most Americans know very little about the American Indian community, and with the Indian casinos being perhaps one of the first things that comes to mind. In Michigan alone, I know tribes generate more than $1 billion of economic activity from casinos. Does that money go back to the community?
Yes, it does. And directly under federal law, it has to go back to the community, although a small percentage of that is shared with local units of government and with the state as well.
So has that been a huge economic boost and a benefit to American Indian communities?
It certainly has. Before gaming, there were homes on the reservation where I'm from in Leelanau County that were insulated by newspapers and cardboard, and very few public utilities were available. Now gaming has sort of brought Indian communities into the lower middle class.
You know, one would think with such an economic fortune that that could only be good news and that things could only be improving for American Indians. Your study finds that there are that's not quite the case. What kind of real challenges is the community facing?
Well, they're under principles of federal Indian law, much of which is decided by the United States Supreme Court. Indian tribes cannot or have very limited ability to regulate and control the activities of people who are not members of the tribe. And so, for example, you mentioned at the beginning of the segment domestic violence. Particularly in the northern reservations, if a non-member commits an act of domestic violence, say, which would be construed as a misdemeanor, the state of Michigan, the tribe would not be able to touch that person. It would be left to the federal government, which has very few resources to take care of such a problem.
Now, from what I understood, we have like 565 tribes around the country, 12 in Michigan. And from what I understood, you said that some tribes are being overrun by non-Native Americans. And I wonder now, when it comes to being in a tribe, do you not you need to have an Indian family lineage, don't you, to be in a tribe?
Right. And what I mean by overrun is that there are large, in some reservations, large numbers of non-Indians living within the reservation boundary. They're sort of in a gray area legally in that, like I said, the state has little control over them, the tribe has little control over them, and the federal government has little control over them. And what this leaves is, tribes unable to respond to this issue. Now, in terms of tribal membership, the key is if you're a member of the tribe, then the tribe can govern you.
So the tribe does not have any decision or any power in deciding who lives on the reservation itself?
They frequently do not. Congress, in its infinite wisdom over the past several decades, has encouraged non-Indians to come onto the reservation as a means of destroying the reservation. And so on one hand, you have people who are really not beholden to the tribal government. On the other hand, you have a tribal membership that is defined exclusively, through the strong encouragement of the federal government, by race.
Now, you say those that are non-Native Americans, the tribe can't intervene in those situations. How does the tribe typically intervene with a domestic violence situation that involves tribe members?
Well, if it's a tribe member, the tribal government and the tribal police are the first responders, as would any local government be. But in the case of a non-Indian, if the person is not of Indian lineage at all, the tribe is unable to prosecute that person. And they might be able to restrain them for a short period of time, but the tribe will have to let them go eventually. And it is extremely unlikely that they'll ever be prosecuted for this. And domestic violence is a particular kind of crime that tends to get worse and worse with repeat offenders, to the point where it becomes felonies and, more serious sexual violence.
So wait, so who has any control here? I mean, if they're on tribal land, but the tribe doesn't have authority over them, does the local government then surrounding the tribal land, are they able to intervene?
Very rarely. Primarily, it is the federal government. And this is where the problem comes in. The United States Attorney's Office for most of the tribes in Michigan is located in Grand Rapids, and that's where the FBI is as well. They would investigate these crimes. But if they're in the Upper Peninsula or the northern reaches of the Lower Peninsula, it will take hours or days or perhaps never for them to actually reach the reservation before they prosecute. You know, the U.S. Attorney's Office job generally is to deal in things like terrorism and drug trafficking, kidnapping and bank robberies, mm-hmm. and Indian country crime is not always high on the list.
I'm talking to Matthew Fletcher, director of the MSU College of Law's Indigenous Law and Policy Center. Matthew, what about social problems like drug and alcohol abuse? How big of an issue is that in American Indian communities, and is it being addressed?
Well, I think given that the national downturn in the economy has made things worse, to be sure, but any tribal community, like any rural community in the United States that is far away from significant social services and from economic opportunities, is going to face all of those issues. And Indian country is no different.
And the power structure then in a tribe, how does that work? Are decisions made in some kind of a democratic fashion? Is there a leader that has essentially most of the control? Or
I'm glad you asked that question, and that goes to the heart of my study, which is about political theory in Indian country. In Indian tribes, the vast majority of them are very democratic. People run for election. You may have a tribal chair who is nominally the president. You have a tribal legislature and a tribal court. What happens and what the part of the problem is for outsiders is that if you can't qualify through your blood quantum or your racial ancestry to be a member of the tribe, you don't get to vote. And I would argue that non-members, non-Indians, should be given, have some recognition of their political rights. And maybe mm-hmm. they're not full members, but they would certainly be important political participants. And if you bring them in, then you would have justification for regulating them.
I see. So there'd be authority placed over them along with their involvement in the governing decisions.
That's right.
And what about young American Indians? Do they often leave the communities they were raised in? Is that a problem now of American Indians not staying in the reservation and with their traditions?
Well, that's been a long-standing issue for sure. You essentially have to leave the reservation to become educated. And that's happening more and more, and I think that's a great success story. What frequently does happen, though, is young, educated tribal members come back to the reservation. They don't always stay for a long period of time. Economic opportunities being what they are, frequently your opportunities for working are in the tribal government itself, which are significant, but for somebody like me, for example, who's a lawyer, there are only so many lawyer jobs on the reservation, and ambition being what they are, people might want to pursue something elsewhere. So that does happen, absolutely.
I did want to touch on the pollution on American Indian land in terms of how much of a problem is it, and isn't the land that we're talking about, isn't that something that American Indian leaders are able to control and decide who's on there and who's polluting?
Yeah, absolutely is the case. And once you're on tribal lands, the tribal government does have authority. The problem comes up with many, many reservations, maybe not so much here in Michigan, but particularly out west, where people, usually non-Indians, come from off the reservation and do their illegal dumping on the reservation, and then they're gone. And the tribe might even know who they are, but they won't be able to enforce any kind of real basic police powers against these non-Indians, because the Supreme Court has said that the non-Indians have essentially not consented to the tribal government's operations, and so that the tribe really has no recourse.
We certainly don't hear about this in the news. Any sense of when or if these issues are going to ever be addressed by the government?
Well, every tribe has control over its tribal membership criteria, the problem, and so they can take steps. That's why I proposed what I did in this paper. And part of the reason I propose it is because Congress doesn't act. You know what goes on, and with partisan politics in D.C., Indian issues are so far down on the agenda that it's almost pointless to even raise them. So there is a movement in the Department of Justice, particularly in the Office of Tribal Justice, to address some of these questions, but it's so easy for one senator to stop proposed legislation in its tracks that there isn't much hope that these can be addressed very well, these problems.
Well, and they certainly are very long-standing. Matthew Fletcher, director of the MSU College of Law's Indigenous Law and Policy Center, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.